Hello, welcome to Literally from the North Shore, and thanks for tuning in. Today we continue with KTWH volunteer Beth Alexander's reading of Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach's book, A River Through Two Harbors. This book chronicles fictional North Shore law enforcement officer Deidre Johnson, who uncovers a crime ring that is trafficking Native girls to the harbor in Duluth. This book contains mature themes and may not be appropriate for all listeners. We pick up where Beth left off last time.
Chapter 11. Pete barged out of his doghouse when she drove up her driveway. He stood waiting, his tail wagging exuberantly and his ears perked expectantly. When Deidre opened the car door, he almost crawled into her lap. "Well, aren't you the perfect welcoming committee?" she laughed as she scratched his ears. If dogs could smile, Pete did. "Come on, boy, let's get you some food, and then I have a call to make. What do you say we take a trip to Duluth this afternoon?" It was early afternoon when she pulled into Ben's driveway. By then the day had taken its toll. Deidre had logged over 200 miles on icy winter roads, had skipped lunch, and had put herself through an emotional ringer, wondering where to go next in the investigation. She needed a friend. Before she could exit her car, Megan and Marin burst from the door, running down the sidewalk in their stocking feet, oblivious to the cold. "Girls, girls, get back here and put on your jackets and boots," Ben shouted, but they were deaf to his voice. Deidre swooped them up in her arms and carried them back to the house. Pete was left in the back seat, trying desperately to join the excitement. The children were deposited safely in their father's arms, and Deidre returned to let Pete out. He immediately checked the shrubbery to see what other dogs had been around, then left his yellow mark on a juniper bush protruding above the snow. They all went inside. Pete, being comfortable with the place, lay down on his pad in the corner of the entry, and Deidre took the twins from Ben. "Oh, I've missed you girls so much," she said as she kissed each girl. "I could just eat you up," and she made a snuffling noise as she pretended to nibble on their cheeks. The girls giggled and twisted as though they wanted to escape, but they didn't really want to be put down. Ben stood in the background, looking on. "Okay, you two honey yucks, let's give Deidre some air." Megan retorted, "We're not honey yucks." "Oh, yes, you are," Ben shot back, and he tucked each child under an arm as he carried them into the kitchen. They squealed with delight. It was Deidre's turn to watch, and she thought, if any children have a shot at a good life, it has to be them. She smiled at the unforced expression of love she was witnessing. After a quick snack, Ben suggested they go to the Duluth Zoo. A sliding hill had been prepared, and for any donation to the zoo's coffers, children could play all day. They packed four inner tubes Ben had stored in the loft of his garage and bundled the girls up against the cold with bright-colored scarves ready to drape around their chins as they careened down the hill. Conditions were perfect: hard-packed snow, crisp air, and not a huge crowd to slow their fun. "Come on, Deidre, I'll show you how we do this." Marin urged Deidre to follow her to the brink of the hill. "We line up our tubes this way," and she placed the rides side by side. "Megan, that one is yours," and she pointed to the one at the far end. "No, that's not fair," Megan spat out. "I want to be in the middle." Marin ignored her sister's complaint. "Daddy, you get this one. Deidre, you get to be next to Daddy, and I'll be on the other end." That arrangement placated Megan. "Now we all sit in our own tube and hold each other's hand," and she plunked down in her spot, reaching for Deidre. When all were ready, Ben gave a slight push to get them started down the hill, and the chain of sliders picked up speed until the snow beneath them was flying past. Near the bottom of the hill was a man-made mogul, and the string of sliders hit it at top speed. In rapid succession, they were catapulted in the air, separated from their tubes, and ended up in a heap on the snowy ground. Megan picked up a handful of snow and rubbed it in her dad's face. He in turn put his cold, wet fingers down the back of her neck, and she squealed in delight. For an instant, the four wrestled on the ground, trying to untangle their arms and legs. Deidre found herself entwined with Ben, and for a moment they stopped laughing. Then Ben, with a forced laugh, said, "Sorry about that, my bad," and he got up, dusted the snow off his clothes, and started up the hill. Deidre was in the middle of saying, "Oh, think nothing of it," but she was speaking to the back of his head by that time, and she doubted if he heard. They played in the cold for over an hour until the twins' hair was stuck to their sweaty foreheads and Ben and Deidre were getting chilled to the bone. "Time to go, girls. Deidre's had a long day. I'm cold, and it's time to make supper." They left the hill amid gripes and complaints echoing from the back seat of Ben's van. Pete was waiting to be let out, and he immediately remarked his favorite bush before wanting back in the house. He plopped down on his pad, stretched full length before curling up, and closed his eyes. "You must be tired and cold," Ben said to Deidre. "Why don't you take a hot shower and then a nap? We'll wake you for supper, and we can spend the evening watching a movie. The girls love the movie Cars. We have our own copy. Afterward, if you want to talk about it, you can tell me about the case you're working." Deidre stood under the hot spray, letting the core of her body warm, letting her body relax, if only for a few blessed minutes. Somehow, she was having a difficult time washing away the memory of that brief moment when she and Ben lay in a tangled heap on the ground. Then she put it from her mind. "Not going to happen," she thought. She dried herself off and was standing in front of the full-length closet mirror. The scars on her chest were still very visible, probably would be for the rest of her life, but they didn't bother her. It was the scars inside of her that mattered, the ones in her mind that no one could see. She reflected back to the day more than 4 years ago when Ben had saved her life. Although she remembered nothing about what happened after she was wounded by a terrorist, Deidre had been told Ben had shot and killed her assailant before he could put another bullet into her prostrate body. She had just put on her panties when the bedroom door was thrown open. Megan and Maren burst into the room. "Oh, sorry," they started to say, and then stopped in their tracks. "What's that?" Maren asked, pointing at the scar. Megan stood with her mouth open. Deidre closed the door. "I had an accident one time." "Was it a big owie?" Maren wanted to know. "Yes, it was a big owie." "Does it still hurt?" the twins asked in unison. "No, not at all. Sometimes it itches, though." "Do you want us to scratch it for you?" Maren offered. "No, it doesn't itch right now." "Can I touch it?" Megan timidly asked. "If you want to." Deidre knelt down and each girl took a turn running their fingers over the healed wound. Their touch was gentle, almost like a butterfly landing, Deidre thought. "Does Daddy know you have this?" Maren inquired. "Yes, your daddy knows about it." "Has he ever seen it?" Megan wanted to know. Deidre laughed. "Well, I certainly hope not." By this time, she had put her bra on and was pulling on a sweater. "I'm going to take a short nap. Do you want to lie down with me?" The girls crawled onto her bed, one on each side of her. They lay perfectly still for 10 seconds. Then Megan popped up. "Is it time to wake up?" she asked. "Yeah, is it time to wake up?" Maren echoed. "No, I need a little more rest. Why don't you girls go down and play with Pete? I'll bet he needs his ears scratched." "Okay," they answered as they slid off the bed. Deidre heard them shut her door and heard their feet as they raced down the hall. The next thing she heard was a knock on her door. "Deidre, it's 6:30. I have supper on the table. Do you want to eat or should we let you sleep?" She rubbed the sleep from her eyes and tried to clear her head. She went to the bathroom sink, splashed some cold water on her face, and straightened her hair until she was satisfied with what she saw in the mirror. After supper, Deidre helped Ben clean the kitchen while the girls dressed Pete in a dolly bonnet and tried to feed him from a dolly bottle. The doleful look in his eyes said, "Please get me out of this." Ben set up the DVD player and everyone sat on the couch, Megan and Maren wedged between the adults. Before the movie started, Megan looked up at Ben. "Do you know that Deidre has an owie?" she innocently asked. Ben smiled at her. "Yes, I know about her owie." "Well, have you ever seen it?" This time Ben had to laugh. "No, I've never seen it." "Well, we have," Maren smugly stated. Then, as children do, they shifted their attention to the TV. "Is the movie almost ready?" Deidre's eyes popped open the next morning as if waking from a nightmare. For an instant, she was confused, and it took a moment for her to orient herself to her surrounding. Her heart beating returned to normal, and she looked at the digital clock glowing on the nightstand. 6:30. At that time of year, it was still dark until 7. The house was dark and quiet, and Deidre put on her robe, quietly made her way downstairs, let Pete out to inspect his personal shrub, and picked up the Sunday paper that had been delivered in the early morning hours. She made a cup of tea in the microwave and sat down to peruse the front page while she sipped the brew. Her attention was immediately drawn to an article with lesser headlines. Minneapolis judge arrested in pay for sex sweep. Members of the Minneapolis Police Bison Racketeering Squad executed a nighttime raid on Saturday morning. They were acting on reports of girls as young as 13 being prostituted at an undisclosed fourplex in Edina. One officer who spoke off the record said the public would be shocked at what was discovered, but for the time being, names are being withheld to protect those who are innocent. At that point, Deidre bristled, and to protect those who have buddies in the system, she said out loud, but she continued reading. Separate information provided by a reliable source has indicated that the multi-unit housing complex is owned by an individual long associated with crime in the city, and that four girls, all under the age of 16, were handed over to social services. Our informant told us only one customer was in the facility at the time of the raid. He was identified as District Judge Tony DeMarcus, longtime member of the Twin Cities legal scene. Deidre sat staring at the paper, her mind refusing to let her forget the sight of Anna Woodsong's body huddled under the bridge. She thought it would be a long shot if there were a connection between the judge and her victim, but the article triggered thoughts about the murder. At that moment, she contemplated a visit to Judge DeMarcus to ask him about his knowledge of the organization he had been patronizing. She knew he'd be hostile, knew he'd refuse to see her, knew he wouldn't incriminate himself. But perhaps, she thought, he might be encouraged to reveal some clues if she approached him with a hypothetical case, speaking as bureau officer to judge. Before she could form a plan, chaos erupted when the girls, leading Ben, spilled into the kitchen. "We're having pancakes for breakfast. We always have pancakes on Sunday. Do you? Do you want chocolate sprinkles on them? We do. Daddy makes pancakes with smiley faces. Have you ever had a pancake with a smiley face?" The questions came at her so fast, Deidre didn't have time to answer. "Calm down, girls. Give Deidre time to wake up." He looked at her and laughed. That evening, Deidre left Ben's as the sun was setting. It was 4:45, and by the time she got to Inga's, the early winter night would have arrived. Again, she was forced to drive in the dark. On the way home, she made a mental list of what she would ask Jill to do in the morning. Chapter 12. Deidre arrived at her office 15 minutes early, hoping to gather her thoughts and start the day with a cup of coffee. As she made her way down the hall, she could see the lights were on, and she could smell coffee brewing. She felt as though she was late for work. "Good morning, boss lady," Jill said as Deidre made her way to her desk. "How'd the meeting go with the Grand Chief?" Deidre didn't quite know how to react. On the one hand, she was irked at Jill's informality. But on the other hand, she couldn't fault the woman's efficiency. "Thanks for setting up a motel room for me. It was nice to not have to deal with that. Much appreciated." Jill caught the point that Deidre hadn't answered her question and didn't press the issue further. She poured Deidre a cup of coffee and asked, "What do you want me to do today?" "I'm at a loss for work this morning unless I rearrange the office furniture, but there are only four corners and it won't make much sense to rotate what we have." She smiled expectantly at Deidre, who tried to smile back. "Send off official letters of thanks to Grand Chief Muzio, Joseph Walken, and Charles Freeman for their support. Then I'd like you to do some research on a district judge in Minneapolis, Tony DeMarcus. Find out as much as you can about a raid on a fourplex in Edina last Saturday. It involved teenage prostitution. Contact the Minneapolis police for what information they'll give you. Play the BCA card." For a moment, Deidre watched Jill scribble in shorthand. "I'm going to Duluth today to interview a boat captain I know, and it might take a while. He's an old Norwegian. Nils is his name. He's a pretty lonesome guy, and it's hard to get away from him once you start visiting. But he knows a lot about the harbor and boats. I want his perspective on what the harbor was like 20 years ago." Jill jotted down what Deidre ordered. "The drafts of thank you letters are in the folder on your desk. Read them over. Make any changes you want. I'll have final copies ready for your signature when you return." Deidre read through the communications. "I can't see a thing I'd change. I'll sign these and you can get them in the morning mail." She left the room shaking her head in amazement. On the way out of town, she stopped at the Holiday gas station on the southwest end of town. As the meter on the pump turned to double digits, Deidre was thankful she had a company credit card. This case was going to burn up a lot of gasoline, she thought. When the tank was full and she collected the receipt, Deidre pulled onto Highway 61, heading back to Duluth. Deep in thought, she crossed over the French River and was almost to London Road in Duluth. The speed limit was 30, and when she looked at the speedometer, it registered 45. Lucky I'm in a marked car, she thought, but nevertheless let her vehicle coast to the prescribed limit. In about 2 miles, she turned onto I-35 and picked up her pace. 10 minutes later, she was at the 40th Avenue West exit, where she left the freeway. Another 3 blocks, and she was at Nils's home. She had visited regularly when she lived in Two Harbors, but it was a long drive from her cabin to Duluth, and her visits had become infrequent. When she knocked on the door of his cottage, she heard a thin voice call out, "Come on in, the door's open." Nils had been a captain of a Great Lakes oar boat for years, but to look at him now, one would never guess he had guided those 1,000-foot behemoths through narrow passageways. These days, Nils was relegated to sitting in a wheelchair and letting others serve him. "Deidre Johnson," he croaked, as his milky eyes attempted to focus on her. "What are you doing visiting a dried-up old prune like me? Don't you know the neighbors will be talking if we meet like this?" He cackled at his own joke. "Let them talk, Nils. If I lived closer, I'd ask you to go steady with me." That made Nils laugh until he had a coughing fit, and it took him several seconds to get his breath back. "Just the thought of that almost killed me," he said, and laughed again. "Nils, I came by to have a talk about something serious. Sorry to have to get to the point this way, but I need to tap into your knowledge of the harbor." Nils became silent. Then he murmured, "Yes, the harbor. Well, I guess I can tell you a few things about that place, but nothing recent. I haven't been able to get down there for years. Don't even get to sit by the canal and watch the boats come into port." Deidre noticed the faraway look in his eyes. "This isn't a pleasant subject for me to talk about, but when you were captain, did prostitutes ever get smuggled on board the Lakers?" Nils shifted his position in his chair, and Deidre could see how thin and useless his legs had become. "Not that I would ever allow it, or any other captain I knew. We had strict rules about that. If any hand was caught trying that stunt, he was immediately fired. If anyone did succeed on a captain's watch, the captain was written up and docked wages. A second incident of that nature led to dismissal. I never knew of a captain losing his job because of such an incident." In a way, Deidre was relieved by what Nils told her. "Of course, what sailors did in port was their own business. We had no control over that. I know many of the sailors weren't angels. Rumor was they met prostitutes in empty railroad boxcars parked by the docks in Two Harbors. A whorehouse on wheels, you might say." Nils sort of snickered. Deidre didn't laugh, so he continued. "No, we kept pretty close tabs on that sort of thing. Of course, things changed when the St. Lawrence Seaway opened in 1959. I had just been promoted to captain that year, and remember well the day the first Salty arrived to take on a load of wheat at the Superior Terminal. Now, they were a different story. In fact, I was told that some, not all, mind you, but some of their captains encouraged prostitutes to come aboard as a reward for the crew. Port security said they tried to prevent it, but I don't think they tried too hard. I suspect some money exchanged hands under the table." "Tell me, Nils, do you know of any women not allowed to leave the boat once the ship was ready to leave the harbor? Did you ever hear of any of them being kidnapped?" Nils went silent for a moment. "I really can't say one way or another. You see, it was as though our crews and theirs lived in two different worlds. We didn't speak their language. They didn't speak ours. I think the girls sort of watched out for each other, kept each other's backs. One of them might know. Of course, I don't know any of those ladies. Most of them are dead by now, I suppose." His gaze drifted to the window where he could see the dried stems of hollyhocks moving in the wind. Then he continued, "I do know this. Things were getting a lot rougher on the docks by the time I retired. That was after the shipping season ended in 1979. He paused. "Now I'm 93. Not much time left, but I had a good life. I'm content where I'm at and with where I'm headed." He smiled winsomely at Deidre, and it almost broke her heart to hear her great uncle talk that way. "I'm glad to see you're at peace, Nils, but I have one more question. If I wanted more answers to the questions I asked, who would you say I should look up?" Without hesitation, he answered, "You'd want to see William O'Johnan. He served under me when he first joined the fleet, worked his way up the rank same as I did. He became captain the year I left and retired in 2010. But you'll have a tough time catching up with him. He spends his winters in Florida. I don't know where exactly, but you should be able to find out." Dieter wrote down the name with a notation beside it. "Nils, can I do anything for you before I leave?" she asked. "Wheel me over to the window so I can wave to you when you go. Oh, and Deidre, happy Thanksgiving if I don't get a chance to see you before then." Deidre walked to her SUV carrying a load of guilt for having neglected the old man the last few years. She made a vow to spend more time with him. Before she stepped into her vehicle, she turned and waved at the sallow figure in the window. He waved back with his bony hand. Deidre wasn't quite sure of what to expect when she returned to the office. What arrangements would Jill have made? "Hi, boss lady," she was greeted. "I've got the info you wanted about the judge. It's in the file on your desk. The Minneapolis police are being pretty tight-lipped about the raid. Seems they're going to be stepping on some pretty big toes, and they don't want unofficial reports leaking out before they're ready. Need anything while you read what I have for you?" She smiled her expectant smile, something that was beginning to unnerve Deidre. "Yes, I need William O'Jannon's phone number. He worked on the Great Lakes fleet of ore boats until 2010 and now lives in Florida, at least during the winter. Where he stays summers, I don't know." "Gotcha, boss lady. I'll get right on it." Deidre didn't know what to say, so she sat down, picked up the folder, and began to read Jill's report. "Judge Tony DeMarcus, one of 62 judges in the 4th District of Minnesota, age 59, graduated William Mitchell Law School 1976. First elected to position November 1999. Married, 3 adult children. Home address, 1300 Lake Calhoun Drive, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 53211. Notes, during early years of his judgeship, was noted for being strict but fair. Since 2006, has shown leniency towards certain cases, especially those involving the sex trade. Since then, he has thrown out 3 cases on grounds of insufficient evidence, also dismissed 2 charges of assault brought against suspected drug dealers. Deidre's thoughts were interrupted by Jill. "Sorry, boss lady. Unless you can raise the dead, you're going to have a tough time getting any info from William O'Jannon. He died 6 months ago, fell off a ladder and broke his neck. You'd think at his age he'd have known better. Anyway, he won't have much to give you." Deidre still wasn't sure how to respond to this working arrangement. What could she say? The woman was more than competent. "I ran off a copy of a Google map for you. It has instructions for getting to the judge's house on Lake Calhoun. If you leave now, you can be there by 4 and still have time to make it back tonight." It was as if Jill had read her mind. She had planned to try to meet the judge. In a half hour, she was in her car and on her way to Minneapolis, realizing the road was becoming all too familiar. She stopped at Toby's, a legendary stop on I-35 midway between Duluth and the Twin Cities, ordered one of their famous caramel rolls and a cup of coffee to go, and was back on the road in 15 minutes. Juggling the coffee and the sticky roll, she managed to drive at the same time. Deidre mulled over what she would say if she had the opportunity to see the judge. She didn't want to call ahead to ask for an audience, knowing the phone would probably be hung up, if it were answered at all. No, she wanted this visit to be a surprise. She thought if she could catch him off guard, she might have a chance. Jill's map and directions were easy to follow, and she maneuvered the streets with no problem. A little after 4 in the afternoon, Deidre pulled over to the curb near 1300 Calhoun Drive. She didn't want the BCA emblem to be noticed, so she made sure she parked down the block. As she neared the front door of his house, she could hear the shrill voice of a woman screaming obscenities inside, but she couldn't quite catch every word. "You lying wretch, don't you come close to me. I've put up with your philandering long enough. No, don't you ever touch me again, you..." Deidre couldn't make out what the last word was, but she could guess. She hesitated before ringing the doorbell, and during that moment's hesitation, the door flew open, and a very angry woman, her jacket open and flapping in the November cold, stormed past. She carried a suitcase in each hand. Janelle Marcus, Tony's ex-wife-to-be, stopped in front of Deidre. "You blonde bimbo, are you lining up to see the judge already? Well, go at it, you little tart, and have a good time with that worn-out old SOB. You'll find out he's not much good in the bedroom or anywhere else. Janelle spit on the ground as if trying to get a bad taste out of her mouth, threw her stuff in a van, and peeled out of the driveway. The judge stepped to the doorway, a drink in his hand. He teetered for a moment and then hurled the glass at the speeding van. It fell short and shattered on the concrete. "Who the hell are you?" he barked at Deidre, looking at her through bleary eyes. "My name is Deidre. I'd like to come in if you don't mind." She smiled as sincerely at the drunk as she could. The judge cursed and said, "I don't want to talk to anybody. Get lost." But then he looked again at the petite blonde who stood on his doorstep, smiling innocently at him. "Oh, hell, come on in. Maybe we can get to know each other." Tony DeMarcus poured himself another drink and flopped down in an expensive leather chair. "So what do you want?" he slurred. "Judge, I need some legal advice. I..." Before she could continue, he broke in. "Leave the SOB. That's what he is, an SOB, in fact." And he pointed his drink at Deidre. "We're all a bunch of SOBs." Tony took a long swig from the glass and went silent, staring at the floor. "Judge," Deidre tried again. He reacted as though he had forgotten she was there, jerking upright and trying to focus his eyes on her. "What?" he asked. Deidre figured she better get to the point before he passed out. "Judge, I have a hypothetical situation I'd like your advice about. From your years on the bench, are you familiar with anyone who might be connected to a prostitution ring in Hennepin County?" The judge looked at her through narrowed eyes. "Hell yes, this county is filled with crime. Every year we try more cases than all the rest of the state. Walk down Hennepin Avenue any night of the week and then ask me that question." "Well then, hypothetically speaking, of course, do you have any judge friends who might be involved with prostitution?" "Hypothetically? I suppose one or two might be." He drained his glass and reached for the bottle to pour another. "If I were talking to one of them, do you think he'd be able to name some names of the pimps involved?" The judge shifted his feet. "Maybe. Might there be anything in it for me if I say yes?" Deidre smiled sweetly at him. "Might be, Judge. But what would your friend have to tell me?" "I think he'd say, Billy Evers." "And where would he say I'd find this Billy Evers?" The judge leered at Deidre. "He's in jail." With those words, he drained his glass, began to make a move toward Deidre from his chair, and fell flat on his face, passed out. "Sorry, Judge. I guess that's all you're going to get. And you're wrong. Not all men are a bunch of SOBs." She let herself out of the house, not bothering to rouse the inebriated judge, and climbed into her SUV.
You've been listening to Episode 6 of A River Through Two Harbors by Minnesota author Dennis Hirschbach. There will be a total of 20 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in next time for more from A River Through Two Harbors. If you miss an episode, you can find it on our website, ktwh.org, by clicking on Programs and then Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down list. Each weekend, we'll post the episodes for you to catch up on. To learn more about human trafficking in Minnesota, go to www.yourcallmn.org. Please join us again next time for A River Through Two Harbors, here on Literally from the North Shore.